show that looks at Kansas City baseball's past, present, and future.
High fly ball. Motley going back to the track. No outs to go. The Royals have won the 1985 World Series.
Davis comes to the plate. Strike three called. It's over. They've done it. The Royals are World Series champions. The world champion Kansas City Royals.
This is the Kansas City Baseball Vault.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome in to the Kansas City Baseball Vault. We are here to bring you as much Royals news as we can possibly scrape off of the news wires, because there is just nothing happening in the landscape of baseball right now. But we're here anyway, so we're going to talk, and you guys get to listen. Lucky you. So before we get started, of course, introductions. I am Jeff Herr, and with me is the man who never freezes over, no matter how cold it is outside, Michael Engel. Mike, how are you doing on this record-setting day of frigidity in the Midwest?
Yeah, we're in the polar vortex.
We need a sound off for that one, for sure.
Yeah, it was cold. It was like -3 when I got up.
That sucks. I looked at my phone. It was -4. I was like, my God.
Yeah.
That's actually a thing. That's not wind chill. That's just like the temperature.
Yeah, that's where you start. So that sucked. Not very fun. But I want to go back to like what you said in that intro is I wish that, like, you know, what 8 years ago, 7+ years ago when we started doing this podcast, that, well, we're here anyway, should have been a tagline.
That exactly. Yes.
Well, we made it here. Because for all now but maybe like listen. 4 months in 2012, that's kind of been the operating procedure. Well, we're here.
Might as well record it.
We hit record. Let's do this.
Let's do this indeed.
And we do it for you, listeners.
We do it all for you. We hope you enjoy it. If you do, tell us about it. If you don't, tell us about that too.
Yeah.
But
we may or may not make changes. Don't know.
Who knows?
I don't know.
Speaking of who knows who the hell's actually going to sign anywhere, anybody, this offseason? And before we jump into the Royal specific stuff, we were kind of talking about this right before the show. Like, last year was absurd in how quiet the offseason was, and it was constantly there was a lot of talk about, oh, is there collusion between the top, you know, between all the baseball teams? They don't want to sign these huge contracts, etc. And nobody really knew what the deal was. And it's been even worse this year. And you've got you were mentioning this before the show. I mean, we've got Bryce Harper and Manny Machado out on the market, two legit surefire superstar, all-star, MVP candidate type, Bryce Harper and a former MVP in his case. I mean, and there hasn't been hardly more than just some rumors. You know, I mean, there's been talks of Chicago and Philly in on Bryce Harper, and you know, just your typical names that are in on Machado. But man, just nothing really super concrete or like, hey, this deal's going to get done and here's what it's going to be or whatever. It's just it's nutty, isn't it?
It is. It's pretty crazy that, you know, those guys just there's no market, and it's or there seems to be no market. Now, I think any team out there could probably find a way to fit these guys on their roster and in their payroll because they're players who are worth that. But like, it is interesting that a team like the Royals, for instance, a few years ago, they were pretty active as far as like finding settlements and arbitration and doing everything they could to avoid an arbitration hearing, to the point that it was like a kind of a record for Dayton Moore that he never went to an arbitration hearing because they settled with everybody, even after they exchanged figures. And then all of a sudden, 2 years ago, every team becomes the quote file and trial type of team where they're just going to put in the numbers and they're not going to settle and they're going to let it come down to arbitration. And it's weird that every team did that when there were, I don't know, 10 to 12 teams that would still kind of negotiate after that. It's just curious. And then at the same time, there's a lot of slow off seasons. It's very, very bizarre. And, you know, I think, go ahead.
It almost felt like it was like a point of pride for many teams to say, like, oh, you know, we don't go to arbitration, or we never been to arbitration. And that was almost a selling point for free agents, because you knew, okay, this, you know, even though by the time you're a free agent, you're not going to be dealing with arbitration anymore, that still kind of sends a signal, sends a message saying, hey, you know what? We take care of our guys. We don't want to try and jerk you around. We're going to be a straight shooter with you, et cetera, et cetera. So I feel like that was all kind of part of the kind of building your brand, if you will, as an organization. And yet, yeah, now it just seems teams just don't care. And I don't know if it's because they've realized that they have more negotiating power, and so they don't really care about trying to negotiate, or they've realized the players have more power now, and so they're not. It's perplexing for sure.
Yeah, I kind of get the idea that teams are smarter, and they are. They're smarter about evaluating talent and placing value upon talent, and especially when you're talking about guys who are into their 30s and things like that. You know, you can definitely tell. We talked about the aging curve year after year after year on this show, and many other people will bring it up. And it's very clear that in your 30s, baseball players will decline. And there's a lot of times where baseball players are hitting their first big contract when they're about to hit their 30s, and now teams aren't spending as much. But the thing is, Bryce Harper is not in his 30s. Manny Machado is not in his 30s.
No.
So that's kind
they're
of...
They're what, 25?
They're
26?
They're children. I mean, they've been playing at a high level for years already, and they're still well in the middle of their prime, and God, they might even be still plenty of prime to grow into. So for them to really have hardly any steam on them here at the end of January, like spring training, like they're loading the truck for spring training tomorrow. Yeah. Bryce Harper and Manny Machado are not close to signing with anybody. It's bizarre. It's so strange.
Yeah. And it's so weird to see how this is going. And I think the only thing you can really maybe look at in terms of, if you want to talk about, okay, well, teams are getting smarter or just getting, you know, having a different outlook on things, the kind of first of this era of these mega contracts was the Alex Rodriguez contract in the 2000s, right? Where he was the first one to sign a $200 million contract, I'm pretty sure. And that was a 10-year deal. And then that got passed off, you know, from the Rangers to the Yankees, and the Yankees kind of had to wear that the last few years of his contract. Yeah. And then you see what happened with the Angels and Albert Pujols.
Yeah, and Josh, you know, Hamilton was in there too.
Josh Hamilton as well, and then Prince Fielder. And, you know, these mega contracts, they were just like, oh, okay, well, we can just give them out and spread it out over 10 years, and it's not going to be a big deal. These guys are Hall of Fame players, and – well, you know what? Even Hall of Fame players get, you know, the time call comes for everybody. Yep. So it maybe they're kind of just like, okay, we need to figure out a way to, but the problem then now, and I think the teams have realized this, okay, we got ourselves into this mess. We set this market. We set the expectations of what the players are. And then when you've got an agent like Scott Boras, who can take that and run with it, then, and well, next thing you know, it becomes very difficult to say, yeah, well, we understand that, you know, Clayton Kershaw's worth $300 million, David Price is worth $300 million, but we don't think any player is worth that much anymore. So it's tough to be in that position. And so maybe that's part of what it is. I don't know. But it's really – it makes for a boring offseason if you have to do a podcast, you know?
It does, but I'll take it over the alternative of what the offseason in 2 years is probably going to be like, because that might be pretty bad. Might be a little depressing once the CBA expires. So,
yeah, we'll have to see what happens there.
Yeah.
I wonder if that's actually interesting, because you can bet both sides are going to point to, you know, these last couple offseasons as evidence for whatever they want to happen. So it's going to be, yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how that all develops.
Yeah, that's a word for it. Interesting and terrifying. I don't know.
That's you.
I mean, baseball's been without labor, strife, such an easy buzzword since you know, settled in 95. It's, they probably are due, but man, you still don't want it to happen. Like,
no, definitely not.
I don't know any other way to correct it. I mean, the rules are the rules right now, and baseball teams are well within the rules to do this. It's, you know, questionable ethics and competitively and all of that, but it's, they're not technically, I mean, unless of course there is clear collusion and, you know, intentional manipulation that way. That's another story. But for the most part, everything that's above the table is within the realm of the CBA. So, I mean, it's something that would need to change before anything else changes.
Yeah, it's a weird position because, you know, I see it from both sides. And I, you know, if I'm a player, I'm like, hey, like what I was just saying, you guys, you meaning the owners, you know, you created this mess. You guys have the money. We know you have it.
Yeah, you've paid it for years.
You can spend it. We don't want a salary cap because we know you can spend it. And we, you know, we want to get our money. So I totally understand that. But then I also understand the point, you know, and let's remove for the second, for, you know, that we're talking about billionaires here when you're talking about team owners. Just looking at it from, you know, it's not good to have someone making $30 million on your team who's hitting 250 with 15 home runs. You know, I mean, that's, they're not providing a ton of value to your team, whether they're making, you know, 30 million or 20 million or whatever. You know, I mean, there's definitely a dollar value set on those kinds of numbers. So there needs to be a market correction. And it kind of reminds me of football in that, you know, I don't know, I can't remember when they changed it, like 2011-ish, I think. But there was, you know, draft picks in football, especially if you were like the number one draft pick, and they used to have these absurd contracts that would be the, you know, immediately would be the biggest contract in the league. All the veterans are pissed, like, hey, what the hell?
Yeah.
This guy hasn't done anything. Sam Bradford, for example, signs a $75 million contract before ever setting foot on the field. And he wasn't worth a dime of that, to be honest. I mean, he has hardly done anything in his career. And good for him for making that kind of money. But, you know, so the owners were like, we don't want to deal with this anymore. Let's find a way around this. And so they corrected it. They had the scaling and everything very similar. They actually kind of used a similar model to what baseball uses for their draft picks for the salary scales and such, but so I don't know what's going to come of it, but we're definitely going to find out here soon enough.
Yeah, so that's something to look forward to.
Yes, indeed. So as we're on positive notes, we actually do have some positive things to talk about.
We do
this week, a couple of them. First, we'll start with in the off season, kind of off season tradition for lots of for many outlets that write about baseball and specifically about farm system development, et cetera, Baseball Prospectus, Baseball America, they've come out with their top 100 lists. So the Royals, so far we've seen two, Baseball Prospectus and Baseball America, have both come out with theirs. In total between the two lists, four separate Royals. It's actually kind of interesting, and we were talking about this before the show. So for the Baseball Prospectus top 101, the three Royals that they selected were Sully Matias, AJ Melendez, and Khalil Lee. And then
all hitters.
Yes.
Interesting to note.
Right. And then they're all, what was it, 52 to 67 was the range for those guys?
Yeah, Matias is number 52, Khalil Lee was 61, and Melendez was 67.
And, you know, before we jump into kind of talking about those guys.
Firmly in the middle of those rankings.
Yeah, so solidly in. And the reason that we bring that specific point up is because then you look at Baseball America's list, and they only have one player from the Royals organization on their top 100, and that's Brady Singer, which is odd because, you know, if you were to compare the lists, you know, especially for farm systems with multiple players, you know, let's say a team has five players or something, you know, you might see, okay, these five players are on this list, and then four of the same players are on the other list, but one of them didn't make it. Or something, or maybe that one was switched out for somebody else, and they were kind of borderline guys in the, you know, high 80s, 90s, etc. But to see three guys in the Baseball Prospectus Top 101 in that just solid middle range of the list, but then just not appear on the Baseball America list, that's kind of unusual. And, you know, again, if it was just one of them or something, you might say, okay, they saw, you know, one group of analysts see one thing and the other group just doesn't see it the same way or whatever, but it's weird. And then, you know, flipping over to the other one, then the one person that is on the list is not on the other one. So it's kind of weird how it all shook out this year.
Yeah. I don't, I'll have to look closely, like what they've explained as far as methodology, because it's got to come down to something like that. You know, it's always, it's always difficult to judge off of what are their minor league numbers versus what are the tools that scouts see. And in the case of like Singer, he didn't pitch in 2018 for any like real organized team. He did, you know, workouts and instructionals and stuff, but he didn't really pitch in games. And so there's no minor league statistics to judge. So it comes down to just what have they seen? And, you know, he's a former college player of the year and, you know, has all the kind of intangibles, and a lot of people think highly of him. And that's what definitely is what's going to put him on Baseball America's list. But then you look at guys like Matias and Lee and Melendez, and Melendez is kind of one of those guys who's starting to break out as like, you know, he might be the guy out of this group. I mean, we talked so much about Matias and even like Nick Prado and Khalil Lee, but he's starting to get some of that steam behind him.
It's been interesting to see his rise just kind of slowly trickle in from a couple of years ago. And then now all of a sudden, you know, he's, or not all of a sudden, but now he's getting a lot of that real big pub.
Yeah. So for him to not land on that, it's just, it's very weird. And so, you know, I think some of that might come down to, I think Clint Scholes mentioned something about how they kind of rate and consider like first baseman and first base DH types, just because those are so dependent on the offensive numbers. And that's sometimes the hardest to really project. And a lot of those guys who end up being those 4A bustable type of guys are often the first base types like that. You know, at least if you're third baseman, you're a middle infielder, you've got some defensive things to work on. But first base, it's like there's not, you know, guys like, you know, Mike Napoli and David Ortiz were serviceable first basemen in the big leagues. You know, defensively, like they could handle it. You know, definitely could, you know, weren't going to be great, but, you know, they hit enough. If you don't hit great and you're not sure about it. So, that, I mean, that might be some of it too, but it is interesting to see that. But it also follows up on some years where the Royals really didn't have anybody that close. Like last year, the only guy who got it was Matias, was number 75 on Baseball Prospectus. And that was like it. So they're starting to see some guys develop, percolate. There are some other names. You know, Jackson Cower was highly regarded after the Royals took him and pitched well. And Daniel Lynch is also well regarded. Nick Prado, you know, finished pretty strong last year. So Nicky Lopez, you know, a lot of people are talking about Nicky Lopez lately. He's got a lot of that buzz to him as well. So there's guys, there's a lot of players that are considered, you know, pretty decent in the Royals system, whereas a couple of years ago they were really, really trying to reload and rebuild. And so that's definitely a positive, even if the rankings don't bear it out. It's also nice to remember that Salvador Perez was never a top 100 prospect. Greg Holland was never a top 100 prospect. And who else was going to? Oh, Yordano Ventura was never a top 100 prospect. And those guys definitely had an impact at the big league level once they made it. So it's not the end all be all, but it's also, these are lists that are compiled by very smart and very thoughtful baseball people. So it's important to kind of keep them in mind, but it's also important to remember that there's a lot of really good minor league players and not everybody's going to make a top 100.
And the flip side of that also is Chris Dwyer was a top 100 prospect. Christian Colon was, and Mike Montgomery was. So, you know, Montgomery has actually been able to carve out a major league career for himself, but not nearly what they were, you know, predicting he could have been. So,
yeah,
It goes both ways, certainly. It's definitely no guarantee for success, but it's also not a guarantee for non-success if you're not on the list. It's not a requirement to be a good baseball
player. Right. It's not like they check those credentials on your way up.
But I absolutely like what you're saying about how, you know, showing year over year when, you know, the Royals barely had one on the list last year, and now they got three guys on the list, and they're, you know, guys that have been in the system for a little bit. So the Royals are developing some players. You know, Kalili has been in the system a couple of years. Melendez has been in the system a couple of years. Matias as well. So to see that, and, you know, it's one thing for Matias to be on the list year after year, but he's climbed from one year to the next. So now, granted, that some of that could be relative to the, you know, competition, if you will, but that's development. That's what development is. And the Royals are still got a long ways to go to rebuild this farm system, but that's definitely a positive sign. And you think the guys you mentioned, the Jackson Coar, Daniel Lynch's of the world, you know, if those guys after a year in the system, it's, you know, there's going to be a higher likelihood that they make it onto the list next year. So, you know, you could be looking at, you know, the Royals having five or six guys on the list next year. And then you're like, okay, this farm system actually is pretty decent.
I remember this.
Yeah. Wow. This is what it feels like to actually have some talent in the pipeline.
Speaking of 2011. You
know, yeah. Because if Brady Singer has a good year, you know, he's the kind of guy that he's got enough respect nationally because of how well he performed in college, that if he has a really good year in the minors this coming year, maybe even, you know, moves up a level or something, ends the year in Double A or something, and as a college pitcher, that's certainly possible. But you know, he's one of those guys that could just shoot up the boards and be a top 20 guy going into the next year. So, you know, the Royals could have some pretty high ranking guys, and then a couple other ones make the list as well. Yep. So, I mean, this farm system, especially after another draft where they have the number 2 overall pick, et cetera.
Exactly.
So, I mean, coming in next year, you know, the farm system could look a whole hell of a lot better than it did 2 years ago, and to say nothing of, you know, it looking better than it already does right now. So it's definitely a positive sign. Things are moving forward. Things are moving in the right direction. It's good to see.
Progress.
Yay.
Yeah. After some dark, dark years. Well,
yes.
Only a couple. One very dark year. I guess prospect-wise, they've been pretty dark for a little bit. But
yeah, it doesn't feel like as much because we haven't been playing or haven't been paying as much attention. But it's been slowly getting darker ever since that first wave from that 2011 class came up.
Can't even call it a first wave. It's the wave.
Yeah, that's right.
That second one never happened.
It was supposed to be a first wave, but the wave. Yes.
It was the wave. That was it.
Yeah, and it was a hell of a wave.
It was nice. Yeah, yeah. It just, you know, didn't sustain. But
we rode that thing. Like, did you see the clip this week? There was a guy that set the Guinness Book of World Records for riding the tallest wave.
I saw something about that.
80-foot wave. He wrote. I just saw like the little GIF or small video of it. It just was fantastic. But that's who we were, riding that wave, 82 feet, winning that world title. And now hopefully, you know, they can do it again. But it's good to see. And it'll, you know, a lot of the guys that weren't on the list that could be, will be pitchers, hopefully. So it could round out that the Royals will have good hitting and good pitching prospects ready to come up. And then, you know, to go on top of what's already on the squad, which would be, you know, could end up being quite the mix. And speaking of which, that brings us into another good news for the week. So the Royals went ahead and locked up Whit Merrifield on a 4-year, was it $17 million contract?
I don't know the exact total. I
have 4.25-ish.
I have the breakdown of it. Let's see. 1 million, 6 million, 12.7, 14.7. About 16.5.
Okay.
Including the buyout.
So yeah, close to right around there. But yeah. I mean, people were talking Whit Merrifield, the Royals had control of him for pretty much all that time, didn't they? Already?
Yeah.
Like they had the next 4 years. Yeah. So, I mean, obviously they would have had to deal with arbitration, et cetera, but, well, I guess depending on how the new CBA shakes out, which is right in the middle of that period, who knows if they get rid of arbitration or what, but
assuming stasis.
yes, exactly. Assuming as of today, but the Royals had control of him and they still decided, hey, we're going to re-sign him and or not re-sign him. We're going to give him a contract that he deserves. And, you know, based on his performance, we're confident that he's going to keep it rolling. And so that's what they did. I mean, he was the American League hits leader last year. He led the American League in stolen bases 2 years ago. Like he has shown to be a very quality Major League Baseball player. And the Royals have essentially locked him up through since he was a little bit older when he first got up. Going by age, like we talked about how, you know, that we've talked about before too, the kind of aging curve, the prime usually hits in that 27 to 32 age range, and Witt is like 29, I think he'll be this season. So
just turned 30, actually.
Oh, he just turned 30. Okay,
less than a week ago. So,
okay. So you know the Royals have locked him up for the entirety of his prime, and given him good money. So couldn't be happier for Whit Merrifield. Just all around great guy from everything you heard. Nobody has ever anything bad to say about Whit Merrifield, and he has earned it with his 2 years so far of just fantastic play on the field. So good for Whit Merrifield, and the Royals have locked themselves up a solid player for the next 4 years.
Yeah, and I get, like, when he was drafted back in, 2010, he signed for $100,000, which isn't – it's not bad. It's a pretty decent bonus, but it's not – you know, that was 2010.
Yeah.
It's been some time since, and he spent a lot of time in the minor leagues and finally broke through in 2016 and was up for good in 2017. So, you know, he's definitely earned – his opportunity, and now he's taking, you know, we see this a lot where you have players. We saw it with Salvador Perez back in 2012, where he had signed for such a very small amount when he left Venezuela, that, you know, the first chance he got to cash in, he got his money, and it wasn't a lot. It was so very team friendly, as had been noted for years and years until they restructured. But, you know, it's that initial bonus does have an impact when you're talking about a guy who's getting, you know, in this case, Whit Merrifield has six figures, but he's far removed from that. I mean, I'm sure that a lot of that has been thrown around somewhere at this point. So he's able to cash in now. He's going to make $1 million for 2019. Next, or 2020, he'll make $5 million. In 2021, he'll make $6.75. And then the interesting thing is in 2022, which would typically be his final year of arbitration, he'll make $2.75 million, which it's interesting that they drop it there. And a lot of people speculate that that's kind of a tell of where the Royals feel their timeline is internally, that they're setting up some payroll flexibility in that season where instead of a contract, typically, you know, it's 1 year it's this, next year it's that. Normally you would see it structured 1 million, 2.75, 5, and then finish off with 6.75. It normally climbs up, or they can front load it. And this one, they're just kind of they're tweaking it to try to take advantage of something by the time 2022 comes around. And it wouldn't shock me for them to feel like that's a time where they will want to start to spend money, because in theory, that's a time where they feel they're going to be contending again, which is also kind of interesting when you think about the guys we just talked about, Matias and Lee and Melendez, where, you know, some of those guys are at the A-ball level. Lee made it into Double-A. So, you know, about three seasons, those guys should probably be up. But maybe there's a signal of learning from the past where, you know, Hosmer and Moustakas didn't really jump out right away as, you know, impact big leaguers. And it took them a little while to really kind of gel into, you know, being leaders on a team and being a big part of a team. And maybe they're kind of setting it up that way. Or they might just be, it might just be that that's what they want to do. They just want to take that last year, make it as flexible as they can, right now, that's the only payroll that's on the books for that season. So they're going in right now with, you know, they know that that's the only cost they're going to have right now. Of course, it's going to go up, but you're going to have a lot of other contracts along the way fall off, and you'll probably have a lot of young players at that point. Some guys who are probably still pre-arbitration. And so if that gives the Royals an opportunity to have a very low payroll to add more players, well, you know, Whit Merrifield has helped them be pretty flexible in that. So kind of a cool wrinkle in that deal, since it's structured so differently from what you're used to. I hope it works out. Even if it was $6.75 million, that's not much. And by 2022, that's definitely not going to be much. I mean, Chris Owings is making $3 million this season, and I don't expect anything very good from Chris Owings. So,
I mean, the Royals could be looking at a situation where that contract in 2022 might be the second biggest on the team. I mean, as of right now. You know, I mean, I'm sure they'll sign other people at the time, but like, you know, Salvador Perez is going to be there, but you know, most of their big contracts they currently have are going to be gone. So you're absolutely right that their prospects, it could look a little bit like that 2011 season where they've just got almost a roster full of young, affordable guys. And it's, you know, just the natural course of things means it's going to be higher, but that was like $35 million that year, I think, was what their payroll was. And it could be a similar one like that, where it's like $55 million or something, which is, you know, will probably end up being about the same ranking in the league for payrolls as where that $35 million was. So, I mean, they'll definitely have the money to burn. And, you know, I would hope that they would know, just like we know, they don't have the excuse of we can't spend it anymore, because we've seen them do it. We've seen them have the $150 million payroll. So if the time comes when they need to spend that money, no one's going to buy that they don't have it, or excuse me, that they don't have it or they can't spend it. They can do it. So it'll if things fall into place like everyone hopes, then, you know, the Royals in that 2022 offseason could be starting to make some noise. Because I think the plan is for some of those college guys to, you know, get some seasoning this year. Maybe get a September call up or two if they're, you know, moving pretty quickly, and then definitely be up second half of 2021 season or 2020 season, and then get that 2021 to be like the 2013 season was, and then 2022 just ready to roll. That seems like a pretty – that's somewhat reasonable timeline here. You know, you're looking at 4 years where you can have, you know, those guys that are still in single A, like your Matias, et cetera, they'll have time to get the seasoning. They won't have to be rushed. You know, the Royals aren't trying to compete right away. So they've still got a couple of years, and, you know, hopefully plus any drafts in between. You know, who knows who they'll pick this year, the number two pick. They'll have just about anybody they can pick. So we'll see. It'll be, the Royals are the last, you know, year or two, especially looking towards the future, it was kind of bleak, but things are starting to take shape now. You know, they're starting to look a little bit better, and it feels like the organization it was good to kind of, you know, turn the page on everything that was Hosmer, Moustakas, that whole era, and now, okay, we were terrible last year. Yep. We know what the deal is. We're not that team anymore. We're going to have to do it again. We can do it again, but now we got to focus on making that happen. And there they are. So, you know, little breadcrumbs leading us hopefully back to the promised land, but it remains to be seen, of course. But, man, could you imagine if Dayton Moore could do that again? He'd be... I mean, I'm not necessarily
saying great,
I mean, obviously a World Series would be great, but I'm not even saying that, but just, you know, get into the playoffs another, you know, a couple times. If he could just build another team that can have 3, 4, 5 years of winning competitive baseball after, you know, doing it once and then having it just completely dismantled, like, that would be super impressive. Nobody thought it could be done once in Kansas City, and then if he does it twice, getting way ahead of ourselves, of course. But You know, I mean, that.
Why not dream a little?
That solidifies. Yeah, you know? I mean, nothing else going on to talk about in baseball, so might as well make up stuff to talk about. Because then you would start talking about, you know, what does Dayton Moore's legacy look like from a national baseball perspective? You know, it starts to look a little bit like the, you know, Billy Beane's legacy, and a little bit more impressive because he actually got it done.
Right.
In the postseason. So nothing against Billy Beane, but that's kind of the one. Yeah. And nothing against Billy Beane, but that's the one area where he hasn't made it happen. So.
Yeah, that would flip a lot of narratives too, but
yikes.
There is one other detail to note in this Witt contract, and it's getting referred to as an extension, and in theory, okay, yeah, it could be, just because they don't have to tender the contract that leads to arbitration, but I mean, come on, they were going to do this. But there is a club option for the 2023 season that the Royals hold, which would be his first year of free agency after both the current contract he just signed and what would have been his regular scheduled free agency. So that's also something that might get exercised, and it is a club option and not a mutual option for a change. So at that point, he'll be 34 years old. Very possible he could still be effective. He keeps himself in good shape, and you know, if he's able to maintain some of the speed and can make some contact with the bat, he could still be productive at the plate. So that could be a beneficial thing for the Royals, or they just don't exercise it and he goes and hits free agency when he otherwise would have. So that's interesting. And also he noted in his press conference that one of the benefits that Witt found in making a deal now is he doesn't have to go through arbitration. He doesn't have to worry about putting up numbers in order to meet some criteria for arbitration, so he can just go out and play. If that's something that really like weighed on him, then that's kind of a sharp move, because now he literally doesn't have to worry about what his numbers are. He can just go out and play without, you know, worrying about that kind of burden and thinking about how it's going to affect him years down the line. Arbitration is a goofy, kind of gross process anyway, in some regards, because you basically get your team is going to assemble a bunch of lawyers to try to tell an arbitration panel why you're not worth the money you asked for. And the player has to sit through all of that. And like, nobody wants to do that. And if he doesn't want to do that, well, he didn't have to, and now he definitely doesn't have to because he has a deal. So he gets money up front now. He doesn't have to deal with that. The Royals get what seems like it's a discount, pretty steep for a player like Whit Merrifield, who was a, you know, 3-5 win player over the last 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
Should have been an all-star. I think that's an incentive in this contract, that if he makes an all-star team, he gets a certain amount, but which he probably will, frankly, like next year. Sal Perez and Whit Merrifield is probably your two favorites right now. So,
Yeah.
I mean, it's a good deal. I mean, you don't find a lot of guys, even though there are kind of more nowadays, it's starting to develop that way, of guys who can hit around 300 and steal a bunch of bases and hit double digit homers and play all over the field. You know, the Ben Zobrist prototype, you know, that's it seems like a lot of teams have a player like that now. Marwin Gonzalez is a free agent who's kind of like that. And, you know, Zobrist himself was a significant guy. So that kind of puts a lot of value on Whit Merrifield. And the Royals have locked it up at a pretty, pretty good price for the next 4 years. And they can go into each season knowing that's the contract. You know, they don't have to worry about negotiations. It's just done. It's set.
Mm-hmm.
So that's definitely a benefit.
And at its worst, which would be the third year where he's getting the $6.75 million, that's a nothing contract. And so, the Royals don't have really anything to feel bad about in terms of that contract. So, I mean, the only thing that they might worry about, even though they won't have to negotiate, is if Whit Merrifield keeps performing, it might be like a Salvador Perez situation a couple years ago where it was like, well, you know, the Royals are under no obligation to renegotiate, but they might need to because he's did outperform the value so heavily. But we'll cross that bridge when we get there. That's one of them good problems to have,
right,
for sure. So
the only other thing, if it goes belly up and those prospects don't pan out, it's also going to be a contract that will be very valuable for a trade return.
Yes, and
if he's
trade.
Still if he's still playing well, you'll have a guy who can play basically anywhere, except catcher, and probably wouldn't play him at short, but you can play him anywhere else, who can make good contact with the ball, steals a ton of bases, hits a bunch of doubles, hits for power, or decent power at least, for second baseman type, for very little money. Like, that's a good final piece to a lot of playoff teams, and a lot of teams would give up a good number of prospects for that kind of guy. So that's another thing to kind of keep in mind. It's a pretty solid deal on both sides. I mean, I would say that Whit probably by jumping early, he probably cost himself some money. But, you know, one of the things is the priority is to, you know, cash in, set himself up now and not have to worry about a potential injury leading to some kind of issue that leads to him getting non-tendered down the line and, you know, turfing any potential earnings. He cashes it in now and is still going to be a free agent, probably, maybe, possibly, at about the same time that he otherwise would have been. And then it's up to the market. So, you know, clearly he signed it, so I think he's happy with it.
Yeah, and Merrifield signing this contract, I mean, none of us are going to see $17 million in our lifetimes. So, or $16.5 million in our lifetime. Yeah. So the fact that, you know, get that, set himself up, and then at the very worst, you know, even assuming he still plays at or close to the level that he's been, you know, even at the end, like you said, he's not going to have some mega contract that he's going to sign, but he'll catch on probably for a few more. Maybe he'll sign a couple 2-year contracts or a few more 1-year contracts or something, and make a few more million while he's at it, likely. So, you know, he's setting himself up to have some pretty good earnings for his career, especially given how late into the game he got started, literally. So,
yeah,
good for him. I'm
if
happy.
You told him in early 2016, when it seemed like he was just kind of going to stay where he was, that in a couple of years he'd be cashing in a, you know, $17 million contract. He'd probably live with that.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, when we heard about the Alex Gordon contract, it was obviously a happy moment because of everything Gordon has done for this organization, and he was a homegrown player, et cetera, et cetera. It was pretty cool. And then, you know, we were kind of holding our breath in the Hosmer situation and the Moose situation and everything else. And, but even when we heard the news about Gordon, it was still kind of like, man, that's a lot of money. Who knows how well he's going to perform for the rest of that contract. And, you know, those any fears we had at the time were completely well founded and have turned out to be on the nose, maybe a little too on the nose. But, you know, it's been a little bit since I think the Royals have signed any sort of a contract, really, where outside of like a 1-year deal with something, where I'm just like, you know what, I feel completely and utterly fine and happy with this deal. And that's where I'm at. I like Whit Merrifield. He's been a good player. He deserves the money. It's not a huge contract. It's not going to prevent the Royals from doing anything. It's literally a perfect scenario for a baseball team.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a good win-win for both sides. So you don't always see those. Like,
no.
It's pretty right in the wheelhouse of both sides of it.
Yeah. You know, you're either Alex Gordon, where you're getting this contract and, you know, you unfortunately don't live up to it, or it's like a Mike Moustakas thing where you test the market and you don't get it. And so the Royals are like, well, we'll give you this $8 million if you want it. And you got to take it.
You
so,
want to get traded in July? Cool.
Yeah.
We'll trade you in,
you know,
July.
We'll see if we can find you a place. So, I mean, that's, those are the alternatives, I guess. And, he cashed in when he did, so good for him. But, unfortunately, I think that's kind of it for, I mean, shit, that's some of the biggest news in baseball is Whit Merrifield signing. I mean, that's how quiet it's been. I mean, we were talking before the show, just what has actually happened. And, Greg Holland signed, the former Royal, of course, signed with Arizona, as you were telling me before the show. I hadn't heard that. It was this afternoon, you said. What were the terms of that contract?
1 year and like 3.5 base salary. And I think he can get up to like 5 or 6 million.
So pretty
small, but he was really rough with the Cardinals last year. And, I think he pitched better once they dumped him, but he hasn't been the same since, obviously, he destroyed his elbow in the process of trying to get the Royals into the playoffs again.
Pitchers rarely are.
Yeah, I mean, he's but it gives him an opportunity, and he gets another chance to try to do something. But that, not a lot of movement. Neil Walker signed with, I don't even remember who, for like $2 million, which seems silly. Again, Chris Owings signed for $3 million, and I'd rather have Neil Walker than Chris Owings. But
right, and I guess the kind
not
of
my team.
I guess kind of the final piece that you've seen some kind of whispers about with the Merrifield trade is, and we talked about Nicky Lopez at the beginning of the show, and him being a middle infielder, people are like, well, if the Royals have sewn up their middle infield with Alberto Mondesi at short and now Merrifield at second, what does that mean for Nicky Lopez, who might be ready pretty soon, who's a middle infielder? But I really don't know that I see much of an issue with that. First of all, number one rule of baseball, it's not like football, where you've got a player that, you're blocking them, that it's just the way baseball works with the young players. Like if you and how drafting works in the minor league system, you don't ever build your team like that unless you've got Bryce Harper.
Yeah.
And you say, okay, we want to pave the way for him. We don't want to, don't want to block him in any way. But unless you've got that, once in a decade generational talent, you can't build your team with any sort of that in mind. So that's number one. But then number two, Merrifield played some outfield last year. He's played it before, in his, in his baseball history. So I think it sets up pretty well. And I think I saw David Leske was the first one that I saw to kind of mention this on Twitter, that it's probably, a very likely scenario would be, so if Nicky Lopez does turn out to be ready and ready to take that role, he comes in hopefully right at the time that Alex Gordon retires, or at least is no longer a Royal. And then boom, Whit Merrifield goes and takes his position in left field. So that seems like a pretty easy transition. So that was kind of the only other piece of that discussion that I really saw going on. But I don't think that's much of a concern at all for anybody involved.
No, it's not. It's weird that Nicky Lopez all of a sudden is getting the free Will Myers treatment. I was like, what? Really? I think it was mostly like, I think the language of calling the contract an extension, it flipped out. Like John Morosi kind of jumped out and brought up that question of Nicky Lopez first. And it's like, okay. And then Joe Posnanski kind of piggybacked on that. And then it's like, hold on, what? Everybody who like follows the Royals is like, what? Hold on, what? Because Nicky Lopez isn't even on the 40-man roster. I think he's going to be a good big leaguer, but he's not on the 40-man roster. Like they don't have, there's nothing that compels them right now to find a spot for him. They can take their time. And moreover, Nicky Lopez can play third base. Whit Merrifield could play third base. You could find a way to get those guys in a lineup together. It's not a matter of blocking guys. They've got some positional flexibility that is going to work. They'll find a way to make it work if Nicky Lopez pushes their hand that much. Like if they have to find a way to find him a spot for him in the lineup, you can figure it out. They're not going to be too, it's not going to be difficult to find a way to get at bats to those guys. So it was a weird, weird concern that popped up. I'm just like, I don't know. It was very random concern that just came out of nowhere. Like, okay.
Indeed.
Like, they could have not done this with Merrifield, and they still would be in the same position as far as, like, Whit Merrifield would still probably be on the team, you know, in 3 years when Lopez would theoretically also be up. I mean, it was going to be a problem no matter what, quote, air quote, problem, you know.
Right.
Like, they'll figure it out. But I don't think it's something to worry about. So that was, that was kind of weird.
Yeah. So not worried about that. But I think that kind of sums it up in the world of Royals baseball. That's pretty much what's been going on. Is there anything else we want to hit on?
I'm out of stuff. I mean, the Royals still need to get some bullpen arms out there, but they're taking their time. There's a lot of guys still on.
As is everyone.
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing seemingly creating any sense of urgency for baseball teams to sign baseball players. Everybody's just kind of waiting around. It's very, very surreal and weird.
Yes, it is. So hopefully we'll hear some stuff soon, because it's, like you said, they're packing up the trucks tomorrow, a couple weeks from now. We're talking pitchers and catchers, and then it all just starts to go really fast from there. So this season is upon us. You know, the Super Bowl is this week, and football season will be over, and it'll be everyone's focus will shift towards college basketball and baseball.
Yep.
Well, at least everyone around these parts. I'm sure somewhere somebody cares about the NBA and the NHL, but not as much in Kansas City. So
yeah.
So all we got to do, Mike, we got to get through this next 24 hours of brutally cold weather. It's supposed to be 60 this weekend. It's going to be good.
Nature's broken.
Yes. We're going to be okay. But so I think that's it for us. We'll leave you there. Thank you all so much for listening. We'll be back in a couple weeks here, right around the time that they'll be getting ready to have pitchers and catchers loading up for spring training, and hopefully have some more news to talk about, Royals or otherwise, because it's been a slow offseason. Brutally so. I've seen lots of writers and baseball writers and stuff on Twitter complain about that as well. They're really scraping for stuff to write about because there's nothing.
Yeah.
But so hopefully that changes soon. Until then, we will see you next time. Thank you all so much for stopping by. On behalf of Michael and myself, we love you all. Couldn't do it without you. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time. And as always, go Royals.
Thank you for listening to the Kansas City Baseball Vault. You can find us on Twitter at KC Baseball Vault. You can also find us on Facebook under the title Kansas City Baseball Vault. And be sure to check us out on iTunes. If you haven't subscribed already, you can find us there as, you guessed it, Kansas City Baseball Vault. If you have any comments, questions, if you want to say anything, it's a free country. Email us at KansasCityBaseballVault@gmail.com.